Good afternoon. You are tuned into Juneau Afternoon here on KTUO News in Juneau for Monday, the 2nd of November in the year 2015. Jeff Riley here today. We'll be talking with Jordan Niger and Paul Marks about the new activities at the Zagorin Youth Center. Marjorie Hamburger and Andrew Bogar will be here to highlight the City Museum's First Friday presentation all about disasters. We'll find out more about the Southeast Alaska Organization for Animals and their upcoming third annual silent auction and dessert auction. And we'll talk with Harvey Van Patten about making furniture from twigs. At Writers Almanac Music and More today on a Juneau afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain, chance of snow later on. Forecast for Tuesday, chance of rain and light snow in the morning, then rain in the afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A northern Wisconsin tribe says an environmental firm it hired is recommending further study of Army munition barrels that were dumped into Lake Superior. As Danielle Kading reports, the barrels were dumped into the lake during the Cold War.
The U.S. Army dumped more than 1,400 barrels into Lake Superior during the Cold War. The Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa has recovered and analyzed contents from 25 of them. But project manager Gary Defoe Jr. says that's not enough. He says they hired contractor Rodolphe Environmental to do an investigative report on the barrels. Reading from a prepared statement, Defoe says their contractor is recommending more barrels be raised.
Remaining barrel contents are still uncharacterized, and the potential exists for inadvertent recovery by the general public. While the barrels are presently containing their contents, they should not be expected to do so into the definite future.
Defoe says the tribe has sent the report to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which provided funding for it through the Native American Lands and Environmental Mitigation Program, or NALEMP. Kimberly Bond is the program's manager.
We will do our review of the report and make sure, you know, all comments and questions are addressed, and then we will try to get the report in some kind of final form.
Bond says the final version will then be submitted to the DOD. She says that could take another 4 months or so to pull together. Bond says the Defense Department has the final say on whether any further action should be taken based on the findings. The Department of Defense is required to fund the NALEMP program at no less than $12 million a year to address environmental impacts on Indian lands from former DOD activities. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A school employee in Southwest Alaska has been recognized for his role in stopping a recent alleged school shooting attempt. As KYUK's Charles Enoch reports, the Lower Kuskokwim School District Board of Education gave out the recognition last week.
45-year-old Harry Nivak is the on-site technician for the Ayapun School in Newtok. He says he was on his way to work on the morning of September 11 when he noticed a former student nearby the school. Nivak says the teenager was holding a .22 long rifle. Thinking he was going off to do some target practice at the river, Nivak left his vehicle and walked into the school driveway, but that's when he noticed something.
He followed me and right there, and then I knew he was going to go inside the building. And then I grabbed him on his chest. And then when the rifle went up this way, I followed his arm and then took away the rifle.
After Nivak secured him, he says the teenager mentioned to him in Yupik that he wanted to hunt the principal. Then Nivak says someone came out of the school to retrieve the rifle and ran to find the local village police officer after alerting the faculty. Later on, troopers arrived in Newtok to arrest the minor. On Friday morning, around 20 representatives gathered at the district office for their morning meeting. At the beginning of the meeting, Board Chair Susan Murphy presented a proclamation of recognition.
Now, therefore, the Lower Kuskokwim School District Board of Education does hereby proclaim Harry Nivak of Newtok, Alaska, is recognized as a hero in averting another possible school shooting and the possible loss of life.
Nivak does not consider himself a hero. He says he was only reacting on instinct at the time, doing what he thought was best. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Reality TV star Dwayne Dog Chapman of the show Dog the Bounty Hunter is aiding in the search for Rose Downwind. She's the granddaughter of American Indian Movement co-founder Dennis Banks. Chapman is helping with a $10,000 reward for information leading to her whereabouts. Downwind has not been seen in more than a week. She was last seen in Bemidji, Minnesota. Family and friends are among those looking for her and have created a public Facebook group to help with the search. Bemidji police are asking for anyone with information to call the police department. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. This program supported by the Peace Corps, the government agency sending thousands of volunteers to live and work alongside people in more than 60 countries worldwide. The Peace Corps will allow you to share your unique cultural heritage and promote world peace and friendship. We have rewarding work opportunities around the world in education, health, agriculture, environment, and business. It will change your life and the lives of others. More information available at peacecorps.gov. That's peace, CORPS.gov. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host for today. In the studio with me now, Jordan Niger and Paul Marks here to talk about the Zach Gordon Youth Center and the activities they have going on there. Thank you very much for coming in.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So, could you please give me an overview of the Zach Gordon Youth Center?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a lot of things happening out of the Zach Gordon Youth Center. It is your community's youth center, and we are right across the street from K2, actually, right next to Centennial Hall. And we have, you know, our hours are during the week 11 till 9 p.m., and then Fridays we're open till 10, and Saturdays we're open 3 to 10. And so, you know, lots of kids come and hang out and play basketball and do art and all sorts of different activities. And today, the reason that Paul Marks is joining me is he's going to be teaching a class on Saturdays starting November 14th through December 12th. And so we're just starting our recruitment for kids to come and take part in some cultural activities. And we have, we're just doing signups. So if, as you listen to Paul talk and get excited about what's going to be happening, and if your family is interested, you can give us a call at 586-2635 to sign up. It will be free, and it's a collaboration between Zach Gordon Youth Center and Gold Belt Heritage Foundation.
Paul, can you tell me about your class, please?
Yes. Well, first of all, I'm just really excited to start this once again. We had a really nice time last year. And so this year we'll basically be doing the same thing as we did last year. And one of the things we want to encourage is that we want families to be involved, and we want the parents or parent, whoever would be in the guardian to the student, to come to the classes also and to participate. And some of the things we're encouraging doing is the language and trying to help those who want to learn a little bit or a few words in Tlingit. And also we'll be doing some artwork, some painting, and then we'll also be making drums. And these activities are very fun, and they're really nice that the parents are able to get involved too. We also allow the parents to do the activities also.
How do you go about teaching a language?
Well, there's a whole different type of ways of that we all have our different ways of teaching. But I try to make it in the sense of make it a feel like a home type environment where it's not really like a classroom type thing, but it's more of just introducing sounds of the language and then also introducing maybe some nouns and then also trying to introduce some vowel or verbs also. And it's really difficult to really try to get involved because it takes a long time to learn any language. And so we're just introducing the language to the families.
I really love the sound of the Tlingit language. And I was wondering if you could just say a few phrases for people to, so they can get the feel of it.
Oh, thank you so much. Zach Gordon Cook Ke Kuchicha Ustin Ha Yeju Nien Yeju Tunecha Gold Belt Heritage Foundation Ka Zach Gordon Youth Center Yewe Ke Kuticha Gunal Chi Shachisa Hachi Ah Kwan Yewe.
Thank you so much.
I invited them all over here.
To my house or your house?
Your house.
Is it difficult for people to get the hang of it?
Or, yes, it is difficult only because the English language is, you know, has so many sounds, and then you use different muscles, you know, and then when you talk Tlingit, those muscles aren't used, and also sometimes what happens is that the English phonetic sounds drown out the true Tlingit sounds, because when you say a word like gunnachish, all the words or all the letters have a sound. So you can't leave out one part of that letter. If you do, it could mean something else or it could mean nothing.
That's interesting. I never heard talk about the muscles before.
Mm-hmm. That's my basic theory, because when I speak Tlingit, even just that little few phrases, I can feel my muscles right here kind of like warmed up. And so, and I get tired when I speak Tlingit, but I think it's also in both the use of the muscles, and then also it's the English trying to dominate over the Tlingit. So one has to get used to just, okay, English, let's take a rest and let the Tlingit speak.
When are the classes?
So the classes are going to begin November 14th, and they are about a month long. So we'll go until December 12th, and then they are from 1 until 4 in the afternoon on Saturday. So they're actually a little earlier than our normal opening hours. And, you know, like Paul said, we really encourage families to come with their kids so that everybody can participate. If you just want to sign your kid up and you aren't going to join them, if they're under 10, we do ask that a family member or a parent, somebody be there for assisting in supervision. But otherwise, you know, we limit to about 15. So I would suggest, if you're interested, that you give us a call sooner than later, and we will have a list there, 586-2635. It's going to be really fun, and like Paul said, it was very successful last year, so we're excited to do this again and see what happens.
Yeah, I'd like to also add to that, I'm not the only one that's going to be doing the instructing. Mm-hmm. Last year we had Ed Coons and Mr. Coons' wife both helped in the art process and also the foods, and then David Katzik was also instrumental in telling traditional stories, and then we had a new language learner, David Shakley, who helped us and worked with us, and so those individuals will more likely be my assistants also.
I've had David Katzik in the studio before, and it always amazes me, because I just turn the microphone on and he starts talking, and it's just beautiful.
Mm. Thank you.
Is there any web sources on this that people could practice at home on?
Yes, there's. We have some with the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. I think if you go into the Fountain of Knowledge with Gold Belt Heritage, you'll find different things that are recorded, some phrases and some words that you could listen to. And also, see, Alaska has a lot of information. They have also texts. And they also have some things on the internet or in their web page that deals with the sound system. So there's a lot of places you can go nowadays.
I've been talking with Paul Marks and Jordan Nigro about the Zango News Center and the various things happening there, including the Tlingit language courses, which are coming up on the 14th. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, I think that was great. I'd just like to thank Paul so much for doing this for us, because I think it's a really wonderful addition to our services. So really appreciate it.
I'd just like to say thank you to the radio station for allowing us to be on there, and thankful for that Zach Gordon, that we can work in collaboration and then helping and just doing some good, fun things with our families.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead,
mm-hmm.
And here
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 2nd of November, 2015. It's the birthday of the astronomer Harlow Shapley, born in Nashville, Missouri, 1885. He was a high school dropout, went to the local library, got interested in astronomy, was admitted to the University of Missouri, went on to become the first to realistically estimate the size of the Milky Way galaxy, and studied the pulsating stars known as Cepheid variables and used them to estimate astronomical distance. It's the birthday of the novelist Thomas Mallon, born Glen Cove, New York, 1951, author of the novel Watergate and Dewey Defeats Truman, Fellow Travelers, but a gay romance during the McCarthy era, and most recently Finale, a novel set in 1986 in the Reagan White House. In his essay, The Historical Novelist's Burden of Truth, Mallon speculated about the popularity of historical fiction. He said the cyber and fiber optic revolutions have made every person and place on the present-day globe absurdly and instantly accessible to every other person and place. We are more than we yet realize becoming sick of one another. The past is the only place to which we can get away. And if I had one prediction for the millennium, it would be that all of us, including novelists, shall be spending a lot of time, more than ever before, looking backward. Mallon is at work on a novel about the presidency of George W. Bush. It's the birthday of the man who said, "I have never been lost, but I will admit to being confused for several weeks." And that was Daniel Boone, born near Reading, Pennsylvania, 1734. Fought in the French and Indian War, came home, got married, and managed to have 10 children in between his long and frequent hunting trips into the wilderness. In 1767, he ventured into what is now Kentucky, later to the Cumberland Gap, about which he said, "Curiosity is natural to the soul of man, and interesting objects have a powerful influence on our affections. One day I undertook a tour through the country, and the diversity and beauties of nature I met with in this charming season expelled every gloomy and vexatious thought. In such a diversity, it was impossible I should be disposed to melancholy," said Daniel Boone. Here's a poem for today by Sheila Packer, entitled "What's Found." In the tangle of trees and twigs from branches and trunks and roots, in the ephemeral tenderness of green leaves that last a season, in the trembling and wind, the blue of sky and lake, in clouds resounding from a place of emptiness, a chamber that answers in vibration, string and wind, a trembling, brimming, and falling in the place opposite of grief, the place opposite of dark, in the body of lost, in water and air, a star whose light has ended but travels toward us, rising and falling in a cascade of notes, which is not endless, but aching and sweet, like iridescent feathers of wings that rise and fall in the circle of migration, in each flight, music that we breathe. A poem by Sheila Packer, "What's Found," from Echo and Lightning, published by Wildwood River Press and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by TIAA CREF, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA CREF, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games, Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for programming comes from the Capital City Weekly, focused on arts, culture, and entertainment in Southeast Alaska, with distribution at community retailers throughout the region. Information at capitalcityweekly.com.
20 minutes past here, and you are 10-2, listener-supported KTO and Karen Ann. The studio with me now next, Marcia Hamburger and Andrew Bogar. They're both involved with the City Museum. Andrew's here to talk about the disaster program, and Marcia is here to talk about disasters also. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, Marcia, why don't you give us an overview of what's going on?
Well, the reason we're doing disasters at the museum is we've got two exhibits, one that opened last month and will be up for a whole bunch of months, which are historical photographs from Juneau from the past 100-plus years of disasters that have happened, mudslide and avalanche and lots of floods, and some historical information about that. And then opening this Friday, first Friday, there's this traveling exhibit of artwork. It's really beautiful, actually, artwork. I've been seeing some of it getting unpacked this week. And it actually originated in the Valdez Museum when they were commemorating the 1964 earthquake that had a huge, huge impact in that community. And the museum put together an exhibit of, I think there's 28 artists who contributed artworks on this theme of disasters and community. And so that exhibit's opening this Friday, during First Friday, and we have a reception from 4:30 to 7. But then, because we've kind of got this idea of disasters, we're looking to the other community partners, and that's where Andrew and the Red Cross comes in. Yeah.
So, hi. Yeah, I was actually contacted by Marjorie and asked to give a presentation through the Red Cross about disasters and disaster preparedness, and I think that's awesome. And I would love to talk to the community about preparing, and really what was important to me, what really stuck out, was the fact that the Red Cross isn't the only organization in this community that works with each other towards disasters. The Salvation Army's here, and plus numerous others, and kind of bring everyone to the table so the community can really see all the different players that put a lot of time and effort into talking about what can really be a scary subject, so we're ready for it when it happens. So that includes the borough and the city of Juneau, includes us, includes the Salvation Army and other partners. And so I'd like to give a chance for the community to ask them questions and see what goes into that and what that cycle for preparedness looks like, because it doesn't happen just when a disaster happens. There's a long process about talking about disasters leading up to it, and then implementing what we've talked about. And then after the disaster, the cycle's not over. It's still continuing. And it's looking at, okay, what do we learn from this, and how can we do it better and be more quick and be more resourceful with what we have?
So that's on Saturday. So we have this copy and collection series that I think have come in a lot to talk about. So generally speaking, one Saturday a month, try and put together a program that relates to our exhibits and or the museum's collection. So that's what Andrew and his disaster friends or disaster preparedness friends are going to be there on the Saturday at our copying collections at 10:30 to noon at the museum to do that.
As far as disasters go, what have been some big and major ones that happened in the capital city?
Well, you know, Gold Creek for many, many years flood routinely, and until it was, you know, put in that cement channel that we know it today, the way that it runs through town. So that was for many years something that occurred. And, of course, we get tons of rain, so things like mudslides and stuff coming down the mountains.
Yeah. Well, being right up against the mountain like we are, and we do experience, we could experience mudslides like Sitka experienced very recently. Also avalanches, especially with winter coming up, avalanches is something we're seriously looking at. And everything, like for us, what a disaster is large events like this, but it's also goes all the way down to something as small as a house fire. And on the outside, you know, as large organizations go, a house fire doesn't seem like a huge disaster, well, until you're that family. And so we look at everything that goes into that.
And some of the photographs in the museum, a lot of fires too, mm-hmm. particularly some of those memorable ones. Some more recently, like the Holy Trinity Church, and some of them more historically, like the historic Goldstein Fire, when the Goldstein building burnt. Mm-hmm. Forgetting the date right now. But, yeah, so we have fires as well.
Mm-hmm. How many disasters are you profiling?
I can't remember if I've got a number. I'm looking at my little notes here, and I'm not going to be able to tell you right off the top of my head. It was mostly what we were pulling was from, again, our museum's collection of photographs. So it's not comprehensive of every single fire, every single flood, but it's a representation of ones that we have in the collection photographs that we can then put on exhibit and tell some of those stories of some of those kind of historic and important and impactful ones that really, you know, kind of changed the community in some way.
So one of the forms we're using for this, as opposed to, you know, myself sitting there talking to people, is we're bringing in actually a panel of individuals who've lived in Juneau much longer than I have. I'm relatively new here. And so talking about the history of Juneau in terms of disasters for me is a little bit difficult because I'm still learning that as I go. So I rely on my volunteers. I've got a solid, small group of volunteers here that are very active and have years of experience under their belts. And so some of them will be here, and they can talk about some of that. So if people are interested in the history of Juneau, how it relates to disasters, you know, they should come and learn because there's a lot of knowledge is going to be in that room.
And then I want to talk about the afternoon because we have another program that Andrew's involved with, which is for kids. So the panel discussion, which is maybe more interesting to adults, is 10:30 in the morning. But then in the afternoon from 3 to 4, the Red Cross has this program, which is called the Pillowcase Project. And so Andrew's going to be in the museum to work with kids who are interested in that, kind of targeting grades 3 to 5, which is a good age for kids who are old enough to, you know, be able to wrap their heads around this idea about disasters and also maybe even play a role as a partner with the rest of their family. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about that?
So this program was developed after lessons learned from Katrina, and college students taking pillowcases and taking the things they thought they would need, throwing into a pillowcase, and going to a shelter. So Red Cross chapters in Louisiana said, hey, there's something to that. And they partnered with Disney, and they came up with this program. This program is where we educate children grades 3 to 5 about emergencies. And we choose the word emergency over disaster because disaster can, to kids of that age, can be somewhat vague, but it's still intimidating because they hear about it. They hear their parents talking about it, and they can feel the anxiousness parents can have when it comes to this. And so we choose the word emergency. And also, emergencies can also focus on other life events. So we cover a local disaster, and this time we'll be focusing on winter storms. And then we also cover house fires. In amongst this, we'll have events that'll get the kids up off their feet and action. So it's not moving. So it's not just us speaking to the kids the entire time. It's a very long time to expect kids to sit still, and we understand that. And we also do a breathing exercise, that's what I'll be covering is a breathing exercise called Breathing with Color, and it's a coping skill. And children don't really realize they're learning a coping skill. That's exactly what it is, and that can be useful in their life, not just during disasters, but you know. Any stressful situation.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on that, please?
Yeah, sure. The breathing exercise is called Breathing with Color. If you think of a warm, comfortable, positive color in your life, something that you affiliate with positive thoughts, and you breathe that in, and as you exhale, you're breathing out really negative feelings and scary feelings, and we try to associate a color that's not warm and not comfortable to the child. And
so it's kind of like a visualization,
a
physical response.
And taking the time to think about that is actually slowing everything down. You're taking the time to think about breathing, and it really can calm people down. As an adult, it helps too. So I may or may not have used it a couple of times in my own personal life. So I'm glad that we're doing this. And the nice thing about the grades that we're focusing on 3 to 5, it's at that point, it's really they're sponges and they're soaking in some of these more harder concepts to tackle. And that's why we like this, because not also are they learning these and they can retain this knowledge. They're excited to share it. And so they take this preparedness knowledge and they take it home to their parents, and they bring a booklet home with them. And it teaches them the steps that the Red Cross would like to see. It takes building a kit, making a plan, being informed, and all the things that we would like families to learn together. And Marjorie's absolutely correct. It's at a place now where the third to fifth graders are completely capable of becoming part of the family plan. It's here, watch the dog, help feed the dog during a crisis, or cats, and then or help, you know, watch your baby sister or baby brother, or there's smaller, simpler tasks that they can be included in during a disaster. So that can really help out parents as well.
Yeah. So that'll be 3 to 4 on Saturday. And if people wanted to sign up ahead of time, obviously we can only handle so many kids at once to make it really personal and have them be involved. So if anyone's out there wants to confirm a spot, give a call to the museum or stop by and sign up. But also people can show up that day and see if we've got room for them at on this coming Saturday.
You are, both organizations use a lot of volunteers. Quick plug to get yourself some volunteers.
Absolutely, anytime. Would love that. We are always looking for volunteers, especially volunteers from Juno. If you'd like to come work with me, I'd love it. So one thing is you can look us up at redcross.org/Alaska, and that's going to get you to the Alaska Red Cross webpage, and there will be a button that says volunteer. You click on that, and it'll walk you right through that process. You can also find us on Facebook. The Red Cross of Alaska has their own Facebook page. Reach out to us on there as well if you feel you're more social media savvy, and we will work with you. And we're always looking for volunteers.
What kind of things do volunteers do with the Red Cross?
Volunteers can do everything from we need help administratively. We need help in our office here. Just answering anything simple as answering phones is still it's helpful to us here and develops and grows our program. We'd have disaster volunteers, and that's some of the volunteers that will be there at the event. People can speak about disasters, and they operate shelters. They operate feeding operations with partnered organizations. They do preparedness education, going out to other places in the community like schools and churches, and any group that would like to learn more about preparedness for their organization or just their family, we do that as well. And then we also have the Home Fire Campaign. We need volunteers to help us with this, which is a program where we have free smoke detectors, and we would like to install them in residences. And I need help with volunteers that would like to, prevent fires in homes. And that would be a great asset to us as well.
Hmm. And how do people get a hold of you?
They can get a hold of me at 907-347-5841.
And you probably need some volunteers as well.
Oh, yeah, we're always happy to have volunteers. This is kind of our slow time of the year when the tourists are gone, but we often ramp up some of our work with our collections. So we're looking for people who might be interested in helping to catalog our collections, put things online, scan in images and so forth like that. Sometimes I'm looking for volunteers who like to interact with kids and because I do all the programming. So maybe to work with school groups that come and lead tours, things like that. So if anyone's interested in that sort of thing, they can get in touch with the museum and Juno.org/museum, and that's our website, or just Google us, Juno Douglas City Museum. And then, of course, when it gets to be a little bit busier, we need people to work the reception desk.
And I know that they're looking for people pretty much on an ongoing basis to videotape the Coffee and Collections presentations.
We don't have that in place right now because we don't have the equipment, but that'd be something interesting to talk about if there is somebody who would like to, have their special little niche. That would be really great.
Marjorie Hamburger and Andrew Bogart, thank you so much for coming on the station today.
Okay, see you Friday.
Thank you for having
Friday.
Us.
Ship on the sea, bon voyage to you, new Titanic. Say hello to the Statue of Liberty. To wish you a safe crossing is unthinkable. We know at once you're crossing, you're unsinkable. So bon voyage to you, new Titanic. You're the greatest ship on the blue. Bon voyage to you, new Titanic. And your happy passengers and crew. You're the greatest ship on the sea. Say hello to the Statue of Liberty, the fastest ship to ever cross the deep blue sea. Your maiden voyage will go down in history. To you, new Titanic. You're the greatest ship on the blue. Bon voyage to you.
25 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTO and Karen and FM in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host for today. In the studio with me is Bree Brent from the Southeast Organization for Animals, and they're talking about their third annual silent auction and dessert auction. Bree, thank you very much for coming down the station today.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who do not know what your organization is, could you give us an update?
Yes, definitely. So we're a local nonprofit. We started back in December of 2012. We're located main basis here in Juneau and Ketchikan, Alaska. We started, myself and Danita Odell were the main co-founders, and we decided to start. We saw a big need in the local villages throughout Southeast, and we started the rescue to help out those local villages that don't have either local animal shelters or veterinary care. So we started out to help mainly those, and we've started rescuing all sorts of animals, mainly cats and dogs, and we've been able to rehome about over 150 animals from those surrounding villages, Gustavus, Hoona, Angoon, Prince of Wales, Metlakatla, all over Southeast. And we've been able to help out many of those families, which is very helpful for a lot of those local villages.
Now, you don't have facilities to store the animals.
No, we use mainly foster homes, which is obviously a big help for us and for the animals because it gives them a big help in the right step for actually being adopted. So they're able to get the feel for what it is to live in a home as opposed to being in a shelter. There's nothing wrong with being in a shelter environment, but obviously it's a big help for us to be able to have that family environment for them.
About how many animals do you run through your system?
Roughly, probably on a monthly basis. It can vary depending, obviously, on the rescue need, anywhere from 5 to upwards of about 20. Right now, we have in rescue about 25. We're at a pretty busy time right now because it's running into the Christmas season. Unfortunately, the fall time is really busy for us because it's puppy season. So we're pretty busy at the moment.
This time of year is busier.
Yeah, it's busier right now. And then springtime is usually kitten season. Ironically, there is seasons for puppies and kittens. So usually those times, fall and spring, we're a little busier than normal. Obviously, we're more than happy to help out whenever the need arises. So we are open anytime to any requests. And you can always, on our Facebook or our website, aksofa.org, you're welcome to give us a call or an email anytime you need help.
Is there any reason that people put animals up for adoption? Is it because they got an animal and the animal was too much for them, or they just didn't work out with their family? What do people give us reasons for needing to get rid of their animal?
We see a wide variety of reasons. It can range anywhere from, they've had the animal for several years and it's just they're moving and they're not able to find new housing that allows pets, which is unfortunate here in Juneau. You would think for a dog-friendly community that they would find housing, or it could be that they just got a new pet and it's just not a good fit for their family. Either the dog doesn't get along well with their established animals or their kids, or it just could be that they just aren't able to take care of the animals medically anymore. So it really does range for a variety of case-by-case basis.
Is there a fee involved?
For us taking on the pet? No, there's not. We take them on free of charge at any point. There is a fee for adoption. All of our fees can be found on our website, but it ranges per the age of the animal. We do spay and neuter all of our pets before they're adopted. We do microchip, vaccinate to the age of the animal, and every animal is vet checked by a licensed veterinarian prior to being adopted. So that fee just covers all of those medical expenses.
That sounds like a major amount of work.
Yes, it is, but it's very, very rewarding. We couldn't do it without our foster homes and all of our volunteers, obviously. They put in countless hours, and we really do appreciate all their help. So it's very rewarding, and hopefully they enjoy it as much as I do.
How do people volunteer?
They can do, obviously, fostering is one of the major ones that we need. Bake sales, we do a lot of fundraising, obviously, since we're a nonprofit. So we do a lot of bake sales throughout the year, as well as our big event that we have coming up. I've gotten a lot of help for people donating items. They hand knit, crochet, they've made paintings for us, going around town picking up donation items. We're having people help us set up all this week. They're decorating for me, as well as just take down and different things. So if you're interested in trying to help, we can always, use different volunteers. So you can send us an email and we're happy to try to find something for you to be able to do if you're interested.
Is there any maximum or minimum amount of time that people can become foster parents with the animals?
No, we're always open to any amount of time. We've had some people foster for just a couple of days, if that's all you're able to do. Sometimes fostering, you know, it can be a little bit of a lengthy process with some of the animals. And what we try to do is we try to match the animal to the best possible foster parent. So if you're only looking to foster for just a short amount of time, we try to match you with the best possible foster so as to not make it too stressful on you or on the pet. So we try to always match the best potential match we can.
I was wondering, how many times do people sign up to be a foster animal and end up getting, oh, this is so cute?
I would probably say about 75% of the time, because obviously, you know, you have this animal in your home, you devote a lot of time and attention to it, and you do end up falling in love. I've actually been a foster fail, as we call it. You know, you have the pet in your home, and you just can't help but fall in love, and we're totally all for that. You know, we think it's great that these families just can't help but want to adopt, and we definitely, we give our fosters first choice to adopt. So if you do sign up to be a foster home and you end up saying, hey, you know what, I just want to keep this animal that I've been fostering, you're more than welcome to, and you have first choice to sign adoption papers.
And you're having an event coming up this weekend.
Yes.
Want to talk about it?
Yes, I would love to. So we're doing a silent auction, which we've done 3 years in a row, as well as a dessert auction. So we'll have some lovely desserts donated by some of our volunteers, as well as bakeries around town for your auction that you can do. And we also have a whole bunch of different businesses in town that have donated some wonderful items that you could bid on throughout the evening. And then we also have Odom Incorporated has donated wine tasting and some beer that we'll have. Obviously, you have to be 21, and you can purchase tickets either at Rockwell or Contact Sofa, and we'll have those tickets available for purchase throughout this week or at the door. And then we also will have Thunder Mountain Big Band will be playing throughout the evening, which I think will be really fun. They're an awesome band. And then we'll have LuLaRoe with Krista Haller. She'll be having some shopping available for clothing, and we'll have some coloring for the kids, so it's definitely family-friendly, even though we do have some wine available for the adults. Definitely have the kids come. They can dance on the dance floor and do some coloring, and then we'll just have dining downstairs through Rockwell's. If you want to make a reservation and let them know you're there for the sofa event, then they'll donate part of your meal total to sofa, which is really nice. Deb Berry's been amazing through this whole thing.
You say there's clothes available. Is this for the animal or for you?
It'll be for us. You know, us women have to shop.
And that event is happening this weekend?
It's happening on Friday. First Friday, we decided to go ahead and try to get involved and hopefully the crowd to make it a little easier for everybody downtown for First Friday. So it'll be 11-6 from 6 to 9 p.m. at Rockwell's Ballroom upstairs.
And if people would like to be part of the action but can't make it to this Friday night event, is there a mailing address that you would like to share?
Yes. So our mailing address here in Juneau is P.O. Box 33226, Juneau, Alaska, 99833. And then also if you want to just make an electronic payment donation to our PayPal, you can do that online, and it's aksofa.org. And you can find our donate link off to the left-hand side. So whatever is easiest for you, if you'd like to go ahead and donate but you're not able to make it to the event, we always appreciate donations.
Bree, thank you so much for coming down to the station. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just, you know, thank you everybody who wants to adopt, anybody who might be willing to foster. You can find our foster applications online, and we really appreciate your guys' support. Juneau's a wonderful community.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Forest fires have profound effects on birds and other wildlife. In recent years, artificially dense forests combined with longer and hotter droughts have created high-intensity fires where all trees are killed and habitat for all wildlife is drastically reduced. In the aftermath of fires like these, forest recovery may take generations. Under natural conditions, where fires haven't been systematically suppressed for decades, forest fires tend to be of lower intensity. They clear underbrush and seedlings and leave larger trees alive and standing, and even help their seeds germinate. Often, birds can readily rebound from these kinds of incidents. And low-intensity fires can actually increase activity of birds like woodpeckers, which find a bonanza of insects under burned bark and ample snags in which to carve out nest holes. Last year's woodpecker cavities are reused in following years by birds like bluebirds. Birds that eat berries perch on branches of dead trees, excreting seeds that help regrow the shrub layer. In other words, a more open forest, periodically thinned by fire, makes for a more hospitable habitat for birds and other wildlife. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
It's 45 minutes past the hour, and you're in tune to listener-supported KTUO and KRNN FM in Juneau. In studio with me now is Harvey Van Patten. He's starting a class tomorrow at the Jack on making furniture out of twigs. Harvey, thanks for coming down to the station.
Oh, it's a welcome to come in, Jeff. Good to see you again.
Now, first of all, can you describe the finished product? What does it look like, and what is it? Is it a chair? Is it a shelf? Is it a...
You ask all the right questions, because it's all of those. It's anything that you want to make. And I got really cheap building material, twigs that grow everywhere here, alder, willow, and I'm not a twig snob. I don't care what to use. If it's there, driftwood is great, so that's what we use.
How did you get started doing this?
Mother Earth News. I needed some furniture. I had a little cabin on the Oregon coast. There's one of the articles that says you can, if you have a little bit of skill and a desire to do good work, you can make this. And if you want to walk out and go out on the road and put a little sign out, maybe you can make some money. And I tried that, but I found out that being a classroom teacher, that I was out on the loose, that there were a lot of people that wanted to do something on their own, and I still had a teaching ability, and so that's how I got into it.
Is it fun?
It's fun. It's always fun, and I've been doing it for a long time. And I seem to have an ability to let other people have fun doing it, too.
And you work with alder and willow.
We make...
birch.
We use alder, and I call it aldercations.
What kind of tools are necessary?
Okay. Usually, I get a lot of females that come to the class, and so I want to keep it simple. The guys kind of like to overbrain it, and they want to get fancy tools. I use simple hand tools that everybody has in their house. It's got a hammer, a saw, tape measure, and pruners. And I provide the fasteners. And everybody can seem to hit that nail some way or another. They can just saw. They don't saw great. I don't care. They get it cut. And eventually it just flows in and it comes together.
What qualities do you look for in a piece of wood?
If I can use it. So I was coming along. I came from down south, and I cruised into Skagway, and the ferry was going to leave soon. And there's this great little cove where I can find driftwood. And I had to dive in there fast, and it was a 20-foot tide. And I was kind of dancing around, but I got a great supply, and I got over to Hames and battened that together. And driftwood is so fun because it's just all these great shapes. So and then some of the guys says, "Wow, where did you get that chair?" I said, "Well, I just made it." He said, "Well, it looks like an old chair." I said, "Well, it's kind of old." So that's what I do. How strong are my chairs? Well, if you go to the Gustavus Inn and you get a chance to stay there, you can sit on a chair that Jack Lesh and I made 19 years ago.
What do people need to learn from your workshop?
To let go with perfection, just to go, embrace mistakes, and love what you create.
Let's talk about your workshops in general.
The Juno's going to be here at the Jack tomorrow night. And Wednesday night is two classes. First night, we're going to work on foundation. And it's a great one. I have a two-day class because it's the first class is a foundation. So foundation for anything, like a table, a beautiful arbor, a headboard, chair. Basic framework is the same. And then they get to go away. Maybe they work and they're doodling all the next day what they're going to make. And they've gone home and, wow, I got this alder patch out back and now I know what to do with it. And they bring the things in. And the second night, they just create. And it's really easy because on a one-day class, they have to do it all in one. So I've had people come in and say, oh, I had a terrible day. I just look forward to this class tonight. And they just go off to the side and create. So that's what we're going to do.
And we'll start tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night and 5:30 in the Jack. And we're going to have kind of a brown bag so people don't miss dinner. And that's what we're going to do. And the same thing on Wednesday night.
When you make a chair, you say that you don't make that these days too many chairs to sell. You'd rather teach people how to make it. When you do make a chair for sale, how much does it cost?
It depends on where I'm at. I was traveling down the road. I was out in eastern Oregon. I had about $200 worth of auto repairs that I was behind on. And lady says, where'd you get that chair? And I cruised in. And in fact, there were two ladies in Silver Lake, Oregon. This is way out. I said, well, I just made that chair last night. So, well, how much is it? And I thought, well, I'm not in Bend and I'm not in Portland. I said, it's $125. Well, hey, Martha, we can buy two or three of these. And you know what? They bought three chairs. So it depends. But I like to make them reasonable. I sell them. I don't really, they market it. They buy it from me and they get the whole story.
What ages are the people you're looking for to come to the workshop tomorrow night and Friday and Wednesday?
I have all ages. A lot of workshops I like to scholarship a student to come, and that usually is a student who can work with adults. Can be as low as maybe 12 because they have to have some type of skill to operate the tools. I was introducing myself, and this man says, well, I'm a veteran of World War II. And I said, well, I was born in 1944. How old are you? He says, 84, and I'm a log house builder. I said, and you came to learn rustic twig furniture? And he just thrilled me because I thought, at 84, he still wanted to learn something. And that was the best.
How many chairs have you made before?
I haven't a clue. I just have fun.
What should people bring to the workshop?
Well, same thing as Mother knows, an attitude to do good work. Just let themselves learn and have fun and be free, and anything else will just happen. And I try to keep the workshop. I like to build it as a community. So I introduce myself, and everybody goes around the circle. And in that, I try to get everybody to know each other so nobody is intimidated by anybody else, and we work as a community. So it's not about my chair, because they'd ask me, that'd be my chair. I like it. Everybody has an input, and so everybody asks everybody else, and if one person's ahead, I ask them to kind of help somebody else. So I like the sense of community.
I had a question here, but I can't find it in my notes. Where do people get wood?
This will be a little bit more challenging because we're going to be working downtown. I'm in areas where we're not so much there. A lot of times I've taught classes out at the Eagle River Church Camp, and so we would just get materials there. And if I can, I take people with me. So that they see that it's not a mystery. But once they see the materials I use, they'll look out back and say, oh, I got this right here. Because this is southeast and brush grows pretty much. And a lot of people say they're fighting this brush. And I'll say, whoa, wait a minute. I can make furniture out of this. And so then they're like, wait a minute, don't cut that down.
Workshop starts tomorrow And Wednesday, they start at 5:30. How long do they go, and what does it cost?
We're going to work for about 3.5 hours on the first night. We'll get that foundation done and then come back the next night in similar time, and they should walk away with something they're pretty happy with.
And what does it cost?
Cost is $95 for the 2 days, and I provide all the materials and the fasteners, and they provide the energy.
When you say fasteners, it makes me think, is that a nail?
That's going to be a nail, right. Yep, that's it.
Harvey Van Patten, thank you very much for coming down.
Oh.
If people want to sign up and become infatuated with the world of rustic twig chairs, how do they do that? Go to the Arts Council?
They call the Arts and the Arts Council there. Nancy's number, I think, is 586-2590.
Or 2787. 586 Arts.
And Jeff is just great for inviting me on. Thanks very much.
Army Man Patton, thanks so much again.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Arena is now open for the 2015-2016 season with a 5-day schedule. More information at juno.org/parkrec/icerink or call 586-4540.
Well, the forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with a chance of rain and a chance of snow in sheltered valley areas. Low temperatures around 34 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, a chance of rain in the morning, then rain in the afternoon. High temperatures around 41 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain. High temperatures around 43 degrees.